Welcome to Advanced Ball Striking. This is John Erickson, and we've got another interview, a very special guest here today, an old friend of mine and one of the really great persimmon players that I ever played against, Sam Randall. For those familiar with Sam's golf accomplishments during the 1980s, he certainly needs no introduction. For those not familiar, well, it's a bit hard to know where to start. I guess we could start with Sam winning the Junior World Championships in
1981.
Quite an accomplishment. Sam went to the University of Southern California on a golf scholarship and dominated the collegiate golf ranks, winning
13 major collegiate events, which is
really incredible. Most players would, you know, be more than happy to raise their hand and say, you know, I won the Western Intercollegiate or I won some other tournament. Sam just kind of lumps them all into, you know, I won 13 college tournaments, including being runner-up in the NCAA championships. Sam won the California State Amateur Championship. He won the prestigious Sun Bowl Invitational. Sam was a runner-up in the U.S. Amateur. Sam came back the next year and won the U.S. Amateur in 1985 after a runner-up finish in 84. Really impressive stuff. Sam was the Collegiate Player of the Year in the Division I NCAAs in 1985. Players like Steve Elkington, Scott Verplank, I mean, the list goes on and on, Davis Love. Sam was the top collegiate player in the country. Sam was the low amateur in the Masters, not once, but twice. In fact, Sam was in Butler Cabin when Jack Nicklaus won his final green jacket in 1986. Sam was low amateur in the U.S. Open, played on the Walker Cup team, and when Sam turned pro, qualified for his PGA Tour card right out of the box, went out on the tour, and won the Bank of Boston Classic on the PGA Tour's first year as a professional. Really great stuff. We're going to get started by talking a little bit about Sam's playing career from his junior golf days right through his professional career. Then we're going to talk a little bit about some of Sam's playing theories, his approach towards the game, and all kinds of interesting stuff. This will be part one of several installments of a very interesting and articulate conversation between Sam and myself. So let's get started. Sam?
Yeah.
Let's just take a look at your career through the amateur golf, and then you turned pro and you had some success, you know, some great success there winning on the PGA Tour also.
You know, I mean, if we look at it decade to decade, the 80s were really good. I mean, there was Junior World in 81 all the way till winning on the tour there in the late 80s, you know?
What was your first big junior tournament that you won?
Junior World was the big one in 1981, and also the AJGA had a tournament of champions in Florida that I won. Those were the two biggest ones.
Yeah, I mean, I was there at Junior World when you won that, because you were playing in the final group with my buddy Lewis Brown.
Yeah, and then also in the PGA, the Junior PGA, I finished second. Billy Andrade won that, and Billy and I partnered up to represent the U.S. in the Junior World Cup matches over in Ireland, and we won those. That was exciting. That was a real fun trip.
Yeah, I remember, you know, that summer when you won Junior World, you were just on a tear down in Southern California. You were winning just about every tournament. And I remember telling Lewis, I said, you know, this guy Sam Randolph's going to win this tournament this week. And yeah, Lou just couldn't believe it. He just couldn't believe that I'm going to pick the winner of the tournament. And sure enough, you know, you go out and, you know, win the tournament. He ends up paired with you the last day. That was a lot of fun. I have a great memory, you know, going over to watch you tee off.
There was the master of ceremonies introducing the,
you know, the players as they come up to the tee, and they would always mention the qualifying score. And I remember him saying, okay, Sam Randall from Santa Barbara, California, with a qualifying score of 63. Is that right, Sam? 63? And you looked over, you're kind of like, yeah, that's right, you know. And, you know, it wasn't really the kind of, I mean, you almost get the feeling he thought it was a typo or something, you know.
I honestly don't remember what I shot to qualify for that.
Yeah, I remember because it was just kind of so shocking, you know. Most people are qualifying shooting 74 or 75, you know, to get into Junior World. But, yeah, that was some pretty great stuff. So, anyway, so you win Junior World down at Torrey Pines. You know, great golf course, a lot of history there. That must have really given you some confidence, I would think, huh?
You bet. Anytime you win against a good field, you get a lot of confidence from it. Proves you can do it.
So you win Junior World. That pretty much opens up, you know, the possibilities for collegiate golf where you can pretty much play anywhere you want. So how was the recruiting process? I mean, obviously about every school in the country wanted you to come and play for them, and then you chose USC. How did you end up at USC?
There were a few choices, but growing up in Santa Barbara at La Cumbre Country Club, where my dad was the pro, Al Geiberger was an honorary member out there, and his sons played out there, and we all became friends, played a lot of golf, and I got to play with Al, and then met Dave Stockton and played with the both of them, and it was a pretty easy decision wanting to go to USC after meeting those guys and being influenced by that, and I'm glad I did. It was a good experience.
Yeah, and those great golf courses that you guys played at USC, I mean, that's just fantastic to be able to play LA Country Club and Riviera, and you guys played, what, Hillcrest and Wilshire?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It was really good, a lot of good courses, and played in a lot of the big tournaments, and the whole college experience was good as well.
I think it's interesting that, you know, as you went through college golf, I mean, you won, what, 12 or 13 college tournaments?
Yeah.
Collegiate Player of the Year, right?
Yeah, 1 year, yeah.
And you were All-American 4 times, first-team All-American, what, 3 times?
Yeah.
I mean, that's really great stuff.
Funny now to read those off. I didn't think about any of that stuff when I played. We just loved the game, and we tried to shoot as good as we could and compete, and the results would just come from doing that.
Now, you mentioned to me the other day about an experience you had at the Olympic Club. I think you said when you were a junior you played up at Olympic Club. Was it the first time you broke 70 or something?
Yeah, I remember the assistant pro taking a couple of us guys on the high school team up to Northern California, and we played Fort Ord in the morning and Olympic Club in the afternoon. And
wow.
That was when I was starting to get good and playing a lot more golf rather than the other sports to go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I remember having my best round ever up there at Olympic Club. Got just one little tip on my setup from the assistant and started hitting it good. And, yeah, I had my best round ever, 69 there. And I can remember we didn't have yardage books or sprinklers. We had on the scorecard, it said, oh, it's 160 from this big tree over here.
Right, right.
Or it's 125 from this trap over here. And that's about all you had. And so we were just trying to guesstimate what it was to the middle of the green and hit fairways and greens and putt.
So you shoot 69 at Olympic Club when you're how old?
Almost 16.
So you were 15?
Yeah.
You're 15 years old, you shoot 69 at Olympic Club on a first look at the golf course.
Yeah, that was a career round, though.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's really some incredible stuff, and I'm not sure people really can appreciate that unless they played Olympic Club, and especially if they played Olympic Club with Persimmon and Blades.
So we move on to college golf.
Your Collegiate Player of the Year, what, was that 85?
Yeah, 85 was a really good year where the putter was hot and things were going my way.
And I know you won the Sun Bowl, which was a great tournament to win because that was they would take all the All-Americans, put them all in one golf course, and then go out and have a little shootout down there in El Paso. I remember playing with you down there.
That was a fun tournament.
In 85, you won that one as well. It seemed like you were really good at winning on the really tough courses. You know, a lot of times a guy would win a tournament on a, you know, kind of a little pitch and putt course or something. But, you know, I remember you winning at, you know, Paso Tiempo, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Alistair McKenzie, you know, great classic course. You got to drive the ball straight out there. And, of course, you know, the Fresno State Classic, our tournament at Fort Washington, which is where they held the PGA Tour qualifying for many years there. You go out there and shoot, 16 under par for 3 days?
Yeah, I hit the ball well, obviously, but that was where I had a really super hot putter. That's why I went so low.
Let's talk a little bit again about, you know, you're growing up with Steve Pate, a great player. You guys are on the same high school team together, which is just incredible. And how did that influence, you know, the development of your game?
Quite a bit. I think a combination of Al Geiberger and Steve Pate were my two biggest influences through college. And Pate is a great competitor with a great short game. And he used to drag the club way back inside. Not drag it, but crank it back inside with his takeaway.
Crank it, that's an interesting word.
During college, he improved that and got it more on plane and continued to become a better player, worked real hard and had a real good career. Yeah, he was a senior when I was a freshman on the high school team, so there was a good example to learn from there, and then in college a little bit. But we also used to play together at Montecito Country Club. His brother, John, is a very good player as well, and we still are friends and play together, and I'd be cleaning clubs and picking the range and making $50 during the week and go play for it all on the weekend. You know, there'd be 12 guys and three groups and matches flying here and there. There was so much to keep track of. I just had to write it all down and go play. And I figured out real quick, you don't want to lose your $50. You want to do your best. You better just play each hole the best you can, and we'll add them all up when we get done, because you can't keep track of all this. And looking back, that was the perfect mindset to be in. And I can remember the competition heating up and seeing a few volcanic eruptions from Steve Pate. That was always interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, he could really get heated up. Well, he cared.
Yeah.
He was into it.
That's how he
got good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, great player. Now, you won the California State Amateur as well. What year was that?
That was 85 also. Yeah. 85 was big year.
Yeah, you won the California State Amateur, and that was at Pebble Beach, right?
Yeah, I remember being the medalist and winning the tournament, and same with the U.S. Amateur later in the year. And, of course, you know, that was probably I wish I could putt like that again, John.
Yeah, right.
That like I did in 1985. Man, maybe I can rediscover that here in the next few years before I turn 50.
Right. Well, you used that ping, was it a ping answer?
Yeah.
So the California State Amateur, you're the low medalist, and you how many matches did you have to win there?
Were there six matches to win there? Maybe five?
Five or six matches to win. Who did you play in the finals there?
We're playing Dennis Paulson in the semis, and then Brad Greer. Remember Brad Greer?
Yeah, sure. Great player.
Yeah,
beat Brad Greer. So that's a great win. And again, you know, you win this tournament at Pebble Beach, you know, on another great golf course. You know, you win at Torrey Pines, you win at Pebble Beach, you know, you win at Pasatiempo, you win at Fort Washington.
I won at Stanford one time by 8, shooting 4 under. The weather was brutal.
Yeah, and that's, you know, another classic golf course that you won on, too. It just seemed like your game was so geared at those classic kind of golf courses that were tight. You had to hit it straight and you had to hit it long if you could, and you were able to hit it long and straight with that low fade off the tee. It was a very controlled drive.
So that was my advantage, is being a good driver with the wood driver.
Mm-hmm.
And just wait for the putter to get hot.
But you were able to win tournaments even when you weren't 100%, and that's where, you know, a guy like myself, you know, I had to be like playing at 95-100% of my game to win, where a guy like yourself probably maybe 70, you know, if you had 70-80% of your game, you could still win the tournament, which was, that's kind of like Tiger too. You know, you just can't win all those tournaments.
You're putting good.
Yeah, you still have to putt, but I mean, I'm sure you won tournaments where you kind of went, you know, I sure could have played a whole lot better too, right?
Yeah, I mean, you could always do a little better every round. Even your lowest round you've ever shot, you can find a shot or two that you left out there.
The
coolest one was from being runner-up in the U.S. Amateur in 1984, I got to go to the Masters in 85.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this too. Let's move on. Let's talk about the U.S. Amateur now. So, let's see. Now, 1983, I played good in 83. That was at North Shore. And then 84 then was at Oak Tree, right?
It was at Oak Tree. That was my first U.S. Amateur.
Okay, so that was my second one. So I remember you there. So you were runner-up there, right?
Yeah, I got to the finals, played Scott Verplank, and he had the hot putter and went on a streak.
Yeah, the hot putter.
And beat me there. I was hitting it pretty good, but... And boy, he was having an unbelievable year that year. Remember, he won the Western Open as an amateur.
Yeah, that was great stuff. I played with him that summer. You know, I always tell this story at the Sonny Hanna Amateur. I'm paired with Scott Verplank, and he hits 8 greens and shoots and shoots 66.
Those cats from Oklahoma State had some short games. They still do.
I'll tell you, that was, I think I hit 15 greens and shot 71 or 2 or something. And, you know, I just couldn't believe a guy could hit 8 greens and shoot 66. I mean, it was a putting display unlike anything I'd ever seen before. So I understand.
He's probably the best putter I've ever seen, I would say.
Yeah, when he was in his prime.
Corey Pavin.
Yeah, that was, So you runner up in the U.S. Amateur. I mean, that's just great stuff. You know, I'm always proud that I made the quarterfinals in the U.S. Amateur. But to be runner up in the U.S. Amateur, that's great. Then to come back the next year and win the U.S. Amateur. Now, you know, that's just great stuff, Sam. I mean, that really is.
Well, I had the hot putter that next year, and that made the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that was when I started having back trouble, I had a chiropractor working on me on the course in the during the finals, and then that was that reoccurring back trouble I kept getting every year after that. And finally, it led to, wow, I can't swing like this. And last, I had a lot of that reverse C, put a lot of pressure on my back, and that was part of the reason I tried to, you know, change my swing around a little bit, is to save my back.
Now, when you won the U.S. Amateur, that was at Montclair Country Club, and I played out there as well. You know, great old-school golf course, tight. I remember the rough being really thick out there, and you know, you must have really struck the ball well that week.
Yeah, I remember my iron game and my putting were on. But like I said before, back then, I didn't understand why my iron game was on or off. Now I do.
And what was the difference between, if you look back to that time in the, say, the mid-80s, what was the difference between when your iron game was on and off?
Let's put it this way. It wasn't about how I took it back, you know? I think making the radical change to the takeaway, the backswing actually getting a little worse, made it even harder rather than easier, which was the goal when you make a change, you know?
Now, okay, so let's go back again to your playing days. Now, you you know, you're the top amateur in the country, and you got some sponsor exemptions into PGA Tour events and this sort of thing. So you turned pro, and did you have to go to the Q School, or were you able to win enough money off sponsor exemptions to get exempt onto the tour?
Back then, you could play in 5 tournaments on exemptions, and I had a chance at the International, my last one, if I would have made it to the very last day with 12 guys left, and it came down to a 25-foot eagle putt. I could have made it on the 17th hole, but I didn't. And so I went to tour school and made it through pretty solid. The first tour school I went to, I was 86. We played the stadium course at PGA West, and it was hard and more intimidating back then.
Yeah.
I shot 6 under par for 6 days and finished 12th. And I think 50 guys made it back then, and even par was the number. And then I remember coming back to tour school again in 91, 5 years later, and shooting 5 under par and barely making it with a shot to spare. Okay? And then I can remember coming back, and this is the PGA West, same courses, so coming back again in the year 2000 to the finals of tour school and shooting 7 under par and missing by 8 strokes. So, you know, by then we had equipment helping us.
Mm-hmm.
We had more good players.
Right.
Remember David Gossett shooting 59 one round and not making it at the end.
Right.
So, you know, and I was also starting to struggle with more back problems, and my swing had gotten shorter, and everybody was bombing it, and I couldn't hit it as far as I used to, so the game was getting harder for me at that point.
Right.
And so it's either, like, fix your back and be able to turn and swing again, or wait until you're 50 and the courses aren't as long.
or wait for the Persimmon Tour to...
Or the Persimmon Tour. I want to play in some of those. That'll be fun.
Yeah, that'll be good fun. So you get your tour card. That must have been really exciting to get out there, and you won on the PGA Tour your first year, right?
At the very end of the season, mm-hmm. Yes. And I can remember making enough money to secure my card, you know, in the summertime. So I was playing at the end of the season with no pressure to keep the card, and, you know, just trying to get in contention and go for it. And that's when I won. And of course, later on the tour, when you're, you know, 140th on the money list, you know, you're grinding out just to keep your job, and that's just a little bit more pressure, not quite as fun. I think it's easier to win when you're already knowing you're exempt and there's money in the bank and let's just go for it. Nothing to lose, you know?
Yeah, I think the guys are grinding it out this week, aren't? Isn't this the last tournament this week?
Yes, it is. They're playing the Nike or Nationwide Tour Championship this week, and the PGA Tour has its very last event to nail down the top 125, and there's also the top 150 matters too.
So, who are the guys that impressed you the most when you of the great players you got to play with? That you know, you saw Jack at kind of the end of his career. But still, you know, winning
playing
the
with Greg Norman was extremely impressive. Ball striking, especially his driving.
Yeah.
I remember when it came down to the iron game, Johnny Miller was obviously great. I didn't play with him very much, but I remember Tom Kite. I remember especially Scott Hoke really being able to hit just all kinds of irons right at the flag stick during a round and. Really impressive.
Yeah, he's kind of underrated player, isn't he, Scott Hoke? He could really play great golf.
One of the best iron players I ever saw. Mm-hmm. You can ask some other guys on tour, they'll tell you the same thing. He could just cover the stick.
And the best wedge players you ever saw?
Kite was great wedge player. Hubert Green, great with his wedge. Obviously, Seve, tremendous, impressive. Bob Lohr was really good with his wedges. Remember Bob Lohr?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Trevino, obviously, and there's a few more guys, but...
And the straightest driver you ever saw?
Calvin Peep.
Yeah.
And Fred Funk.
Yeah. Yeah, and how about this Joe Durant out there? I mean, every year he's just at the top of the stats, huh? On the
combination ball of get it out there pretty far and hit tons of fairways, so the total driving stat is him.
And he seems to lead in greens in regulation. I think he's leading again this year.
Yes, so he obviously isn't the best putter.
No, apparently not.
And, you know, we'd have to measure his wedge, too, because, I mean, if a guy wedges at 3 feet and the other guy wedges at 8 feet, who's going to get up and down more?
Right, right. If you look at most of the great ball strikers, at least certainly the guys that I, you know, played against and knew of, kind of a piercing ball flight, you know, a little lower trajectory.
Yeah.
And that's something I know you used to do. When I was down in Australia, I got to play against Peter Senior and, you know, some of those guys that hit that same kind of really low piercing ball flight. Because especially coastal courses where you've got wind and the courses are tight and it's natural to want to keep the ball down. And I know you growing up in Santa Barbara on the coast, I think La Cumbre is a pretty tight little golf course there where you grew up. And I'm sure a lot of your basic instinct for developing your ball flight, you know, would have evolved out of that. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, and you'd say so even more for guys in Texas, which I moved to later, where you got to keep it down under the wind.
Boy, isn't that the truth. Keep it under the wind. Boy, you must have learned a lot playing LA Country Club.
I mean, LA Country Club, just really one of the great golf courses. A lot of people don't really know about it because it is sort of a course that they don't really hold tournaments on, but really just a fantastic course. How do you think that helped shape your game, playing out at LA?
Well, you get to match your game up against a championship course. So as good as it gets, whether it's Riviera or LA, the North Course. Yeah, you learn how to shoot under par on courses like that, and you can pretty much do it anywhere else.
Yeah, you seem like when you played, you didn't really have a comfort zone like some guys did. You could tell a guy would get a little nervous, you know, if you get 4 or 5 under. And it just seemed like with you, you just wanted to keep, you know, making birdies and just see if you could get it 7, 8 under, whatever, you know, was out there.
Oh, well, hey, I can remember clearly, you know, the first couple times you get 5, 6 under par and, you know, you've got 4 holes to go. You can definitely make the game harder. Little things can happen. And I can remember having to learn to let it go and trust it, even though you're, you know, starting to get scared and thinking about guiding it. And I can remember having to find a way to let it rip without it being able to go left. Because the course I grew up on, there was out of bounds to the left on the 16th hole and the 18th hole. So, I mean, right down the edge, so... If you were trying to get it to the house with a good round, you had to avoid left coming in.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because I know, you know, we talked about this a while back. You set your golf swing up so that you faded the ball with your driver, and then you would draw the ball with your irons.
Yeah, and that was interesting to me. I can remember as a pro later on when I started searching how to get a little bit better, thinking for a little while that maybe that's not right. Maybe they should both go the same direction. Of course...
after, you know, all these years and coming back around full circle, maybe that was actually really good and just didn't know it.
I think it's really good because what it does is it creates a biomechanical balance within your body, you know, so you're never getting too one way or the other. I know, you know, my own game, if I was hitting it left to right, if I start hitting it too much left to right, then, you know, the whole game would kind of go that way, and then you got to kind of work it back. But I think with you working it left to right with a driver and drawing in the irons, you know, it just seems like it would create a real sort of harmonic balance within your body.
Yeah, the other thing, I learned how to just rip it as far as I could when I was younger. And, you know, if you put it back in your stance a little bit and trap it and hit a draw, you can hit a 7-iron farther, you know?
Let's talk a little bit about playing by feel.
I know we talked about, you know, yardages, and one of the interesting, you know, in the old days, guys didn't use yardages, and I've interviewed John Henrik, a great Canadian player, and, you know, he played in the era of Hogan and Snead and all that, and he said that, you know, they just didn't use yardages. There weren't even 150 bushes back then. There was nothing. They just kind of sighted everything. And their distance control was very good. You know, Ben Hogan never used yardages. He felt it was ridiculous because there were factors like humidity and other things that he just felt, you know, wouldn't really give much relevance to it. In the more modern game, you know, we all use yardages and yardage books and pin placement sheets and all that. But I know you mentioned the other day that you would do these little guessing games with your caddy.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that.
With 150 bushes, and I can remember playing amateur golf, I would go check and step off. I had my step nailed because I'd practiced on the football field.
Mm-hmm.
I'd step off the 150 bushes because some of them would be 146 and other ones would be 154 or something. And as long as I knew that, my ball was going to probably be somewhere within 50 yards of that, I could just kind of sight, that looks like about 25 yards behind it. Okay, 175 to the middle of the green. Oh, the pin's a little up. Okay. Right? And we would play the quadrants of the green, kind of knowing, still knowing within a few yards of what it is, unless you run into the one, you know, odd where it visually tricks you and you can't see something. But that's why you play a practice round. You'd figure out, ooh, that one actually is a little farther than it looks. Yeah, my caddy in the day of, you know, laser guns and yardage books and you've got a number to everything now, the front over the bunker to the back. I mean, sometimes the yardage book's got way too many numbers in it to me. It's like, wow, I don't even know all that. And it used to be fun when my caddy's standing there whipping up the yardage. I'm looking at it, and I'd go, what do we got here, 147? And he'd say, 146. That was pretty close. And I was eyeballing it, and he was using the exact deal. And both of us became kind of surprised how close I could guess. It was rare for me to miss by more than 3 yards. When I was just looking at it.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And to me, what that's really saying is that you had the ability to intuitively gauge the yardages without the yardage book.
Correct. Get it within 5, right? Yeah. That's 15 feet.
Mm-hmm. And what that means is that you're playing golf by feel.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing by feel. You're looking at it and you're feeling. You're putting a number on it, but that number is based upon the feel. You're looking at it going like, yeah, I can feel this shot's going to play, you know. And I wouldn't be surprised if the slight discrepancies that you would have might have just had to do with things like the humidity, the lie, you know, these kinds of things, other things that aren't really nailed down right in the yardage.
Right, but you knew that, oh, that'll mean a little more or a little less.
Right.
I remember Jackie Burke telling me, I had a real good talk with him down at Champion several years ago, and he made the point about this yardage thing, and he says, you know, when we were playing, we would be looking at the green, and if you tried to figure out what would it take to knock it over the green, and if you figured it was going to take a 5-iron to knock it over the green, then you just hit 6, and you're on, right in the middle.
Yeah, I think you could do that. What would it take to knock it over the green? What would it take to make sure that you're short of the green?
Right.
And you can
use front yardages a lot. That's a good thing to know, because sometimes if long's trouble, then hey, you just need to bump it up in the front part of the green with something.
Yeah.
You make par all day.
Yeah, I do the same thing lag putting. You know, I think, how far do I have to hit this to knock it by? How hard am I going to have to hit it to leave it short? Then I set some parameters, and then I go, okay, well, if I have any doubt, I can kind of split the middle, you know, right there.
I would challenge the scratch golfers out there that are trying to, you know, or the 5 handicap that wants to be a scratch, or even the 10 that wants to be a 5. It doesn't matter so much your handicap, even 20 to 10, but if you just take the pin out, go play golf with no pin in the green, so you don't even know where the hole is. Unless you're on a course that has crazy greens, and all you're trying to do is get the ball in the fairway, and then get the ball in the middle of the green, and then be a good putter. Yeah. I bet you that most people would shoot better scores.
You know, you're probably right about that. Because they're gonna hit more greens that way.
Yeah.
And they're gonna have the surprise shot where they walk up on the green. Oh, look, my ball's like 3 feet from the cup.
Yeah. Oh, I pulled a little bit, but the pin was on the left. I got an 8-footer, nice birdie.
Right. Right.
You know, if you win tournaments or play good people, I can know winning a lot of matches in match play. People saying, "Boy, you must have just known you were going to win the match when you got on the first tee," or intimidation. And I'm going, what are you talking about? I always had respect for the other guy. Mm-hmm. and for the game, and I have to concentrate and play well or I'm not going to win. This other thinking, I'm like, where does that come from?
Yeah, that's interesting, because I know, you know, playing against you in college golf, you know, you did bring a certain intimidation factor to the rest of us mortals, you know, because you just won so many tournaments, you know.
You win tournaments, people think you're good, and you don't have to do anything else.
Yeah. But they don't understand the mental preparation that you probably went through every week to gear up for
it. It's hard to win those tournaments. You got to concentrate hard. There's a battlefield to work through and make it to the end unscathed, you know.
So what is it, like, looking back, you know, through your peak years, what do you feel you had that sort of separated you from the rest of the guys, you know, like in college golf, amateur golf? I mean, you've got to remember, you know, 144 guys in the field, somebody, if not a couple guys, are having the best week of their life, you know, whether it's, you know, Rich Beats or, you know, whoever, somebody's just careering it that week. And, you know, you gotta play good to, you know, to beat this guy. But what do you think you had that was special?
Well, I think what helped me be successful in the 80s, mechanically, I had the club in the slot coming down.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think you had
it didn't
great...
really matter that I cranked it back inside, right?
Right.
So I was pretty free of distraction. I didn't have any interference as far as trying to swing perfect. I think playing football, baseball, basketball, team sports growing up till I was, you know, through freshman year in high school, I think that helped with a little maybe competitive edge. And you know, growing up playing with guys that were older than me and better than me, and you know, playing for the $50 you got in your pocket on the weekend when you're in high school, learning how to concentrate on what counts and not be distracted by the other garbage.
Of all the golf I've played, I never once, you know, played in a pro tournament, you know, with a scientist or a physicist that beat me, you know.
Well, that's good for figuring things out, what's right and wrong and how things work. But if you're going to really play the game at a high level, you got to play like an artist, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, the preparation of the golf course, you know, how you're going to prepare yourself, how you're going to plan. Did you feel like you had a real game plan when you'd get on a golf course? Or would you just...
Yeah, where's the fat part of the golf course? Off the tee and into the green? I mean, you know, you pick a little bullseye right in the middle of the fat part of the golf course and trust your swing enough to be able to, you know, and then just play. And you're gonna score with your wedge and putter. I mean, you and I both know that we could go out and hit 14 greens and 11 fairways, and we could shoot 72 one day, and we could shoot 66 another, or anywhere in between, depending on how well you get away with your missed shots and how good your short game is.
Well, those are some wonderful insights, Sam. We've got a lot more to talk about, and in this next installment, we're going to be talking about your experiences down there at Augusta National when you were the low amateur in the Masters, playing with Jack Nicklaus and being in the Butler Cabin twice. And we're also going to talk about how people can get a hold of you and actually go down to the Masters and spend some time there with your with a group that you take down there to the tournament. We're also going to be getting into swing theory, what Sam thinks about the golf swing. Really insightful stuff with the two of us discussing various topics regarding the golf swing. And then we've got other stuff coming up after that as well. We're going to be talking about putting and all sorts of other insights into the game. So we will see you next week.